epically silent and are saving the last part for posterity in case we are unsuccessful in getting a redo of this tape from Grant Pearson in person. This is an explanation, and this is taped on the front of the remaining portion of Grant Pearson's tape that is good.
On the top of the path, then we anchored it, and one man had to go down by himself. There's no other way you could do it because it was straight, and you'd have to go sideways and everything else. And we had all of our supplies dropped down on this bench, and we roped down there, got down there to our camp, and some of them were, or I did rather, and several others, and some of them were about halfway, and gee, I decided there was 3 dozen loaves of bread up on top, frozen bread we forgot about. So I hollered up, hey, have that guy up on top, that radio operator, toss those bread over. And they tossed it over and come floating right down when we put our camp in. It was in the burlap, several burlap sacks. It was just that steep, it never even stopped. Well, we dug, by the time we got there, over a month had passed from the time the plane crashed. And it was about 8 feet of snow had fallen. There was just one wing of this airplane showing up. We dug for 2 days. And it wasn't my job anyway to find any bodies. It was my job to take them in there, and it was the lieutenant who was to find the bodies. We dug for 2 days, and we found a few pieces of baggage and took the number of the airplane. Never found a body at all. And so he wired in what to do, and the general says, well, come on out. But I'll tell you, I don't think there was a little Eskimo who was now in the legislature who was by the name of Jakey Stocker. He was one of those. He's from Kotzebue. He's one of those Eskimos. And he's one of them that I trained. And it was 35 below when we went down over that ice. And when he got down there, he was just like he come out of a bathtub. He was just scared half to death. And when we left, we went on back, took those few things we found, went on back to out to Wonder Lake, and by that time Wonder Lake was frozen over, and they landed with a T-45, and took the boys out, and as they're leaving, I wished them luck, and said, nice trip. Yeah, it's a wonderful trip, they said. I wouldn't do it again for $1 million. So that was one of the little trips I've been on, and I've been on many others. I also was one of the first ones to attempt to climb Mount Hayes, which we didn't make. We got up there within 1,500 feet of the top, and ran into a storm which lasted a week, and we got down to half rations, and then we got down to quarter rations, and finally the weather cleared up, and the same Andy Kaler I mentioned, who was with me on the 32 trip when we brought out the body, Mr. Houston was organized that, and he wanted to try for the top, and Andy, he started quite a lot, and he said, hell, what's that? Let's get out of here. And we went on back down, and old Lee picked us up a few days later and brought us on in. But I could go on. I could tell about the time that my little old dog kept barking, barking, barking. I have many very amusing incidents. I was in a tent. That was during the days when you'd carry your tent and put it up at night. Shut up, you! Shut up, you! I want to sleep. There's a bright moon out. And he kept barking. And after about 3 times, I decided to put on my clothes and go over and cuff him with my mitts. I trotted over towards him, and I got in water about up to my knees. And the river, it started to 40 below zero that night, and the river froze up and started to overflow, and the dog could see this darn water coming down there, and he kept barking, and I'd like to think that he did that to warn me, but I think that he did it because he knew darn well he was going to get in the water. So I pitched my tent, rolled it up, and got out of there, and many other very amusing incidents I've had with my dogs, and like the time a little pup. He kept screaming and barking. I had him out with me, his companion, and I went out and looked out there. Shut up, you! Shut up! And he still kept screaming, and finally I went out there and I heard this ooh, 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 out in the distance. It scared him half to death. And I could talk about my balky dogs and some of the things that I did to break them. Instead of beating hell out of them, I tried to do what I could to break them with this balking. And those were our lifelines in those days with our dogs. Those were our transportation. Those were the ones that we depended upon. And boy, there's no question about it. Sam Smush's dog, too. He knows. He went through that park in the 20s. And before he got to kind of chicken and started to fly. And Well, anyway, I think now I'll let it go with that. Unless any of you have any questions. Jim, if you have any more you want to ask
Reed,
me.
Mr. Reed, I want.
Jim Gale with you on that trip.
Pardon?
Jim Gale with you on that trip.
Yeah, he was with me. He was a good boy. He was the only one I mentioned that was experienced. He's a good boy.
He worked for me over in Rampart Country.
Yeah, there was a lot of those were Alaskan boys. There was Tetnik, who was down now at Marshall. And I was down there a couple of years ago when I was making one of my campaign trips. And this fellow by the name of Bill Allman, who I used to know at McKinley, and I said to the trader there, I had 19 years since I've been on that trip. And I said to him, if see Bill Allman around, tell him that I said hello. Tell him Grant Pearson gives him his best regards. And he looked at me and he said, my God, are you Grant Pearson? I said, yeah. He said, well, I'm Tetnik. I was with you on that 1944 trip. And I ran into those guys. There was 44 of them. I ran into them every so often. Once in a while, I get a Christmas card from them. And I've got a list of all of them. And you don't remember me, but I was so-and-so, and I was with you on those trips. That's what makes it interesting in Alaska. I haven't seen George King for about 3 years, I guess, and I come in there, and there's no mistaking his mug when you see him, of course. His wife is very easy to remember because she's a good-looking woman. But, and Jim here, I don't know, it's been 4 or 5 years since I saw him, I think, but he was in Tecantishna. Sam was the last time I saw him. I flew with him, and he took me on a campaign trip 4 or 5 years ago up there, something like that, about 4 years. I think he took me from Hoosley up to Allakaket, down there. He's forgotten about that damn gas gauge, and I'm glad about it.
Yeah, I did forget all about that. If you had reminded me, I never thought of it again.
You made a count of how many caribou did you count over there? I thought it was about 40,000, wasn't it?
Where, McKinley Park?
Yeah.
Oh, that was Mountain Chief.
Mountain Chief, they're
called. Oh, well, you made a count before on the caribou, on that caribou.
No, I think that Mountain Chief count was the only one they made there.
That was the first one ever made. And Sam, I wrote a history of Mount McKinley National Park, and it was mimeographed. 100 copies made. I got you in there. I got another couple in there, too, that probably a lot of people don't know. Matt Namanum and Cecil Higgins were the first two to ever fly over McKinley. Mm-hmm. They were coming back from McGrath, and they had a Fairchild 71, and they nursed that thing up there, and they skipped over the top of it, and they took pictures to prove it. And by the way, Higgins is still down in Anchorage. I see him occasionally.
I wonder how about Matt.
I don't know. I understand he was in the Army during World War II, in the Air Force during World War II. But Cecil told me Matt tried to go to sleep up there. And, of course, Cecil had his private pilot's license, so he was about getting ready to pile in there to take over when Matt came out of it. But they didn't have no oxygen. That's pretty high to go without oxygen.
Oh, yeah.
They were the first ones to fly over the top.
They didn't have it very long, that's for sure.
And that was just on an impulse. They hadn't planned that at all. Yeah. They just decided to
Same way their other fellows climbed the mountain.
Yeah.
On an impulse.
That's
Have
right.
Have there been any decrease in the game over there in Mount McKinley in the caribou?
Well, there was a decided decrease from, it started in during the bad year of 1928, and it continued up until 1944. Now, it's on the other way around, and there's a good, healthy population, and they estimate by airplane counts and foot counts that there's around 3,800 sheep in there. And the caribou herd is more than four times as much as it was when it got down to its low. Because we had two bad winters, and then the wolves moved in. And the two elements there worked terrific on them. And there was only, according to Adolph Murray and the counts that the Rangers made, there was only 482 sheep in 1944. And then up they go. But that was a very dangerous low right then. They've gone up ever since. A very healthy situation. I was down there about a month ago, and the wildlife is in a wonderful shape down there. It's on its way up. You know, Bob knows. He'll go out in the park and you can see 100 sheep. You can see more than that. You can see them all over the place. Well, they chewed the range off. That's what's happened. And they got in a weakened condition. Then came the wolves. They had a bad winter, and the wolves run over the top of the snow, and the sheep couldn't make it. They just killed them by the hundreds, there's no question about it. And the balance of nature will work. There's no question about it if you kill off all the humans so that they don't enter in it. But when they start going in there along with the wolves, life just won't balance, and you have to do something to balance it. But there's a lot of people who don't believe that. There may be somebody here right tonight that don't believe in that, but that's a fact. If you get an area and get to keep the humans out of there, say half of Alaska, everything, the cycles would go down, and nothing go down, and nothing, they survive. But when the human element enters in there, killing them off, well, it's just too much for them to take.
That's
the history of the whole thing.
The history of the mammoth, you know. We have mammoths here today, but that isn't for man.
Yeah. Well, Sam, is there anything else you want me to tell them? There's a few things I could tell them about you, but I don't know.
They've heard too much about me already.
I don't know. I may have to run too fast to get away from you. I don't know. Once you get up momentum, I think you can catch me.
I'd land on my nose. I got a better momentum.
I'd like to ask you a question.
Okay.
At the time you were planning killing him, did you use oxygen when you got around the top?
No, we never used oxygen at all. We worked our way up. And you start like that. In these later years, since they've been landing up there, you've noticed in the paper about these people having sickness up on the slopes. Well, you start at the bottom and work up. By the time you get up there, you're in condition. But you land up there 10 or 12,000 feet, and you are not in condition, and up you go. And the oxygen will work on you in different ways, the lack of oxygen. On one party, a fellow had convulsions. In another one, like Morton Woods, he just went out of the tent. They thought he was all right, and then he didn't come back, and he saw him wandering around on the glacier talking to himself. And it worked in different ways. And when I climbed it in 1947, I wasn't in condition. That was after I'd climbed it in 32. I was with Washburn, and up at 19,300, I just went blind. I couldn't see a solitary thing, and I sat there for a while, and everything came back. And then I decided, well, I've had enough. I was up at 19,300, so I came on down to the 18,000-foot camp, and then when they got through, we went down together. It just has many different ways. The lack of oxygen won't hit you in any one particular way. According to what I can find out, and what I have found out by inquiring from doctors and the different things, there's no two persons who work the same from lack of oxygen.
The Washburn's party had oxygen when they lived up there, Mr. and Mrs. Washburn.
No, I was with them. I was with them up at 19,200 feet. That little woman, boy, she was rugged. Don't ever kid yourself. She only she's 5'2" and weighed, I think, 102 pounds. Fine little woman. And she just owned the 13 in the party, one woman. She was terrific. She'd carry a pack of 40 pounds, and she got herself in condition. I don't know if you've ever met her or not, Sam, but
so.
Wonderful little woman.
Wonder she didn't get lost behind the smoke lake.
Yeah, she's small.
We know a tiny big lady go across the night, kind of weak for her husband.
Well, the story I like about Fanny, too, Bob knows this one, is a time when I think his name was Morris, the pilot, and Father Fitzgerald coming back into Fairbanks, and they got before the days of the radio and whatnot, and they got into some bad weather, and about the only place they could go was up to Cantishna. Went up there and landed at Fanny's Strip, and that's after Joe and Fanny had separated. So Fanny invited them for dinner, and she had her famous caribou stew, and she had lettuce and whatnot. So it happened to be Friday. Maybe I shouldn't bring this out. But anyway, it's on Friday, and so Fanny had some lettuce. She had lettuce, and Father Fitzgerald was eating the lettuce, and he was eating the vegetables out of the stew, but he wasn't touching the meat. And Fanny says, "What the hell's the matter? Don't you like my cooking?" And he said, "Well, you know, the day is Friday, and I don't meet on Friday." So she went out there and got some more lettuce, and she said, "Here, eat grass, all the jackasses do." Well, anyway, this is a true story. Anyway, when they left a couple of days later, they left for Fairbanks, and Father Fitzgerald said, "Fanny, the pilot's going back. I think that's the fellow that killed them when showing them.
Yeah.
I think he's the guy.
Both sides.
Yeah, I think so. But anyway, he was going back to Fairbanks, and he said to Fanny, "How much I owe you?" "Oh, hell, your money is no good here. Come on in any time. You're perfectly welcome. I'm glad to see you." He said, "What kind of candy do you like?" And look at Fanny, you know that was the wrong thing to say. She said, "Flips." Well, he came back. The pilot came back, Morris came back and brought her 2 cases of Slits beer and a quart of whiskey. That's actually what happened. But Fanny didn't pull punches from no one. She didn't. But to look at her and offer her candy, that was not the thing to do. She was one of the best cooks and best all-around frontier women I've ever met, and I think Sam will agree.
Yeah.
I'll never forget one time he was trapping up Moose Creek. And she came down, there were some traps along where she's trapping. So she pulled the traps up and hung on some men. And she went back a couple of days later, and the damn traps were set again. She takes her hunting axe and busted hell out of them. She said, "Get the hell out of here, or you'll know what you're going to get." Well, they never came back. She wasn't, she could take care of herself any place. And she could mush dogs, and as I said before, she could use all the words, and she manufactured a lot of them that had never been used before, I think. And she was the type of person that I really and honestly would have been glad to call my mother in spite of her hardship. She taught me many, many things. She taught me many things how to take care of myself. And I think in view of the fact I got along with McKinley so well, as I listened to Fanny and Joe, taught me an awful lot. There was a good collection of old timers in there then. There isn't anybody left anymore at all. And I don't suppose there ever will live in there again because there's no economy in there. You have a tourist camp in there that operates during the summer and closes up in the winter. So that's the sum and substance of many of our places along the throughout Alaska, especially on the rivers. Those little Indian villages that I visit so often. I like all the people, and I know most of the people, but that's the same thing. There isn't anything to keep them up. I don't know what's going to happen to them. Any more? Bob, you got anything to say? You got anything to say about how you got me started in politics?
No, no, thanks an awful lot, by the way.
Well, I was going to talk for 2 hours, but I thought maybe that we should need a little rest.
Was very, very interesting.
How long did I go? About an hour?
Yeah.
You've only used half the tape, Grant. We can go another 2 hours.
Well, I used 2 hours, huh? Well, that's...
Keep right on going.
No, that's all I've got to say. And
well, that's interesting.
I think I'm through now. I've had 31 years and a half of government service. But if I serve out this 4-year term, which I don't think I will because they tell me they're going to reapportion these 10 years in the legislature, so I think I'll quit. Let some good Democrats get in.
You remember that time I met you, the dog team up there around Quigley's place somewhere?
Yeah.
Moose Creek or something up there. I forget just where it was.
Well, I'll never forget the cussing out Sam gave me. He said, "Damn, if you would have ever told me that that airplane didn't have no gas gauge on it, you never would have gotten me to fly it over." You'd forgotten about it, hadn't you?
Yeah, I've got all about that. I've done a lot of worse things than that. That would be a minor thing, though.
Yeah, he said, "Every minute I expected that thing to go out on me."
Sure, yourself.
Well, Sam, off the record, you still got your...
A little bit, but it ain't going to be much.
How about your cabin up there someplace? Was that up at the Channel Air Hall?
That's over on that mud hole, big mud hole on the Indian Mountain.
Oh, that's where you used to go in there and fish.
Yeah, I got a lake there. It's 4 miles long by 2 miles wide, and there's 18 inches of water in it.
Well, how do the fish survive?
Well, they don't. They get in there and they die. But over a little ways east of there, just, 42 miles, which is just a few minutes to the airplane, I got a nice little lake over there.
Is that where you got your place where you take them?
No, I got the cabin is on the mud hole.
Oh.
And the reason I put it there's so doggone many grizzly bears over on that other lake. Usually you'd never get a cabin built there. You'd tear it down fast and you'd build it up. There's a bunch of them there. And they're always on the beach watching you, too, You come in there, they come right out off the hill. And they make it their business to see what you're doing when they're there.
What kind of bears? Black bears?
Grizzlies. Grizzlies. Yeah. Big ones. It's about 60 miles east of Indian Mountain. It's on the back of the Ray Mountains. Back slope.
Yeah.
The north slope.
How's your cabin at Cantation?
Well, they tell me a bear got in. I'm going up in a few days now and take a look at it. You want to use it, Jim? If you do,
I thought it'd need airing out in a couple of months.
Yeah, that'd be fine. I don't know. They flew over it and somebody said it looked like there was a bear in it.
Most likely.
Well, I've got that same proposition, too, because around the big lake, I got all nothing but black bears, but there's plenty of them.
Yeah.
And they're pretty raunchy, too. And I play games on them. I take a piece of bacon and wrap it around a bug bomb and wire it on there. And then they come along and they bite this bug bomb and then they do somersaults and everything imagine, And they go away from there. That one doesn't come back. He stays away. He don't come back anymore, but there's plenty more to come back to. I have all kinds of tricks I play on them, but...
Sam, is James, is he still alive?
Yeah.
Is he back?
Yeah, and they just had a flood there, a big flood.
Yeah, I saw that in the paper.
And James, if anything, he's a little better now than he was 2 or 3 years ago.
I spent 2 days with him a week ago.
Did you?
They went up to Bettles with me for a farewell party for an old timer up there.
Well, Andy, I guess he's fine up there at Bettles.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's still...
He's a good guy, that
guy. He's a remarkable man,
Yeah.
We know his
been
wife.
On that hot springs on the Canute, Sam?
Yeah, I know where they are. I've seen them, yeah. But I haven't been right on the ground at them. I've flown over.
They're
one
of the biggest hot springs in Alaska, I don't know.
Well, yeah, they're big. But I don't know, there's a set right back of Cochrane's, too. It's mighty big, and they're boiling. There's one pool in there that boils.
Yeah, I've heard a lot about
that. I thought that would be a good place during the war to get away from the gas so they can't use it up there on those hot springs.
Well, there's another good set on the Ray River,
Where is that?
On the Ray River.
Oh, yes, I know that.
I see somebody smoking up there. I guess it's all right.
Sure, all right. I haven't smoked.
I'll find one.
That's an interesting country over there. And I discovered an interesting thing over there. In the fall, when the moose are fighting, you make a tour of those hot springs and you find the old beat up bulls that got a good licking. They're laying down on that warm ground. Some of them will lay there for 4 or 5 days. Or they move. Thank you. I think one would be plenty.
Can I have
to
have your signature? So I can cash
check. Which one do you want? The one I sign when I rub a check?
Well, you got 15 months. I someone told me you had retired, Jim.
I've retired from the NC as far as all I can earn.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to 65, so I get my Social Security.
Oh, I see.
So I got about 75 to go. And then I'll be done.
Are you going to leave Alaska?
In the winter. Be back in the summer.
Well, I've worked for 8 years since I left there, various times for construction outfits, and I have my Social Security built up now, too. It's damn politics, man. You get in, and it's fascinating as hell. It's a challenge. Jim is mushing along the dog thing. We're flying in there.
Sam?
Huh?
We got a Fort Lewis type of a picture of a state legal of it. Something you know, that summer, and
Vigo?
Vigo,
yeah. I've heard about the one in the picture then.
Big picture of Ruby, I'm sure.
Have they still got that map that Nimrod made?
Yeah. I took it down to Seattle to the
fair. They couldn't find the place.
That is a good picture. That's a good map. I checked that over in 1925, you know, against the geological survey maps and against the figures that I'd made when I went through there on recon. And by golly, you'd have to put that map right down to details, you know, to find any mistakes on it. That is the most remarkable job that I can imagine, you know.
Made by magazine.
Yeah. Sourdough.
Say, I've got one more, Sam, one more interesting little incident to tell about. You know, before the World War I, the Indian chief used to meet at Tanano, and they had their Nushulawayo and whatnot there, and they used to divide up the country into cutting. So they decided to revive it, and about 3 or 4 years, 5 years ago, they had this meeting at Tanano. And so I flew down there, attended, I got an invitation, and I was a little late, and I walked into the hall there, and Hugh Waite, Secretary of State, was starting to give the talk, the introductionary talk there. He was talking to the natives there, all these Indians from up and down the villages, and he said, you know, what the state is trying to do, he said, we're trying to get better and bigger schools, vocational schools, and whatnot, try to educate you. Compete with the white people and raise your standards of living. And he went on and he talked about that for some time, and then he went on and he talked about the mining, which is some of it in that district, and he talked about the fishing, and he talked about the lumbering, and he talked about the different things. Then he come to the Rampart Dam, and he said, the Rampart Dam is a must. We have to have that in Alaska if we're going to develop. We have to have a cheap source of power, and he went on to tell about it. He said, of course, you know, he said that will flood some of your villages with 60 feet of water. And he didn't go on to tell what was going to happen to the people or anything. He just went on and told about that. And after talking about it, half an hour, he sat down. There's a young Indian, and he was sitting there with his eyes closed. He was master of ceremonies, and you wouldn't think he's listening, but he was listening to everything, and at the same time he was listening and thinking about a rebuttal. So when Hill got through, he got up and he said, thank you, Secretary of State. Thank you very much for the most enlightening talk. It was very good, and especially it was very interesting to me that you're going to educate the Indians and then drown them.
Who was it? You wait?
Yeah, you wait. Well, you were stiff enough like that, and he thought a joke, of course. He could have avoided that by saying, you'll be all relocated, but he didn't say that. Huh? Says, educate them first and then drown them. I've told that story many times.
I bet that floored you.
Sure did.
Oh, his crack up was... In the wall
that, by that's quite left, quick thinking, you know, something like that. It was real sharp.
Those Indians are pretty doggone sharp.
Yeah, he was. He is a sharp boy.
About some of those pictures,
and he speaks well.
He
speaks very well.
That's an airplane crack up, all right, because there's the motor and the exhaust stack. So that don't look
good. You know, Candle Creek isn't on the Cougarock River.
No.
I wouldn't know. That looks like that was before my time.
Nimrod made.
I first saw that, I thought it was known, but it's home. And it's somebody, David was looking at this, somebody in Fairbanks.
No, I don't know what the hell Matt is. I guess if he was alive, he would be too old.
Who's that?
Matt Neiman.
That Neiman, yeah. Probably. No, he would be old. He wasn't old.
Somebody over there might
probably 65.
No, yeah.
Stuff I've been gathering.
That may be Will Rogers' crack up right there. Yeah, the Cougar River or anything like that.
I got your letter. I as a politician, I answer them all. When I got it from you, I was very pleased. I figured, I never forgot about that damn plane without any gas case. I had the gas case, but I had it at home.
Yeah, I remember now. I had to do Isabella Pass there, and I worried.
Yeah, you told me you had a bunch of headwind going through there. Yeah. Those damn little things, and only those things. I would take a little bit more. But you told me, damn, you had a hell of a headwind, I remember going through there.
Yeah, I took a headwind.
And then you landed up at Rapids or someplace and you had 5 gallon or 10 gallon up in the truck.
Hilton, you remember Tehune?
Oh, yeah.
Well, he drove the truck in the family. And he left a case of gas for me there beside the road and a trailer.
You know a fellow who crashed to his death, who I didn't think he'd ever do it, was Christensen. God damn, that was a good one.
You and I both. Now, I made a remark at the time that I could have never expected old Christensen to get caught that way.
That Thunder was a position flyer. He could fly that number. He flew that swallow later, you know, for a year. And then Aho learned to fly on it. Tavio Aho, you remember him? He later crashed too, didn't he? Does Noel ever come up here anymore?
Yeah. He's coming up in August, for sure, and he'll probably be up here before that.
I could have told about the time I flew with him into the Haines when he landed his den. I'll never forget that as long as I live. We landed among a bunch of goddamn boulders, and he got out of the kick from the Colorado's out. And Noel said, "Jesus, we've got a regular airport here now." Made 3 or 4 trips in there. You know, he was a very much underrated pilot. He was a hell of a lot. He was a very cautious pilot.
He never pushed himself.
No, he never did. He's still around like you. Still around. I told that story on YouTube there where you went in with that 71 with that gas one. And when you argued with the inspector about that damn woman's case, I told that many times. And I said, "Sam went over there, by God, and he had the damn teeth hanging down that lamp. And the gas came all on him. He spent 3 or 4 months in the hospital."
Well, it was a lucky day, you know. I mean, unlucky to begin with, but I got out of it all.
Yeah.
I couldn't hope to get out of that. But I got that written up in June last.
I haven't read your last one, Sam, because I haven't had time. But I've been reading them.
I don't know. It's a good idea to find out.
I saw a lot of hustlers.
Did you?
Last summer.
I'll be darned. I went by there this year and she wasn't home. It's
no,
out there.
Going outside.
Yeah. Flower is by Maud, I believe it's the sign there. But the other side is that. You know, there isn't a one. A little old time with Western Cantation, I don't think alive even. There's about 50 of them when I came in there, not a one of them.
You know that field that they made up there by Wonder Lake?
Yeah.
Joe Clark landed on it first. I landed on it second. And I don't think anybody ever landed on it again.
Never did.
It fought out and slid down the hill.
Yeah,
I broke the landing gear when I took off.
Joe and I was in there.
Huh?
Joe and I landed in there.
Oh, you and Joe were in there.
Yeah. I got a cabin. I staked a home site, 5 acres, right near the banks of Moose Creek. And it's within 150 feet of where that field starts. Yeah, and I walked over and told the people about it. And she's all floppy now. You can land there. Eagle can land there.
We were in there, Molly and Anderson was on the lake.
John, yeah.
I took Johnny Boozer out of there. He had a
Tuesday.
Tuesday, yeah.
First airplane he'd ever ridden, if any.
Johnny Boozer?
Yeah.
Boy, it was bad shape. The doctor operated on him that night when I got him in here.
You know, you were in there just before he died. And show you the kind of guy he was. And I went up there and he's in bed, and Jim had tried to get him to fly to the hospital, and he wouldn't fly yet. And I went up there the night before, and I was going to cancel all the different flights. Johnny fumbled underneath his mattress and came up with about $300, and he's dead. Now, I owe, Northern give me the bills, I owe the MC company $160 to go, but they got it under the fire, $180 or whatever it was. And I owe Captain Alley for some dog food so much. I think it was something like $4 left or something like that. Now he said, when you come back, I'm going to be dead. I won't be here. And he said, you'll be sure and pay those bills. And I said, all right, Johnny, I will. I thought he would just, I thought he'd come out of it. Well, I got into park headquarters, and I was out at the park service, and they had radios between us. When I got in there, he said, the word to come to Johnny, it died. Well, I have this this money, you see. What I should have done was put it in his estate. Instead of that, I dropped the mail at the MC company and paid the other company. Never said anything to anybody. But before he died, he said, now remember, I want to be buried up by old Mr. Jim. That's his old dog. Big old dog. Remember that big old dog?
I sure do. I got a picture of him.
Yeah, and he said, I want you. I don't want nobody else. I want you to preach the funeral service. All right, if you want, I'll do it. I've never preached a sermon in my life, but if that's what you want, that's what I'm going to do. So we made a good box for him out of plywood. We buried him up there, and I talked about 10 minutes, and then said the Lord's Prayer, and we put him away. And then I got that mountain named back out back of the cabin. I got it named after him.
Good.
He was a good. He was a good.
He was. First time I ever see him, and he was. I don't know how he walked right up to me. He said, "I understand you're okay." He said, "Well, I shot one too many cowboys once, so you take right in fucking jail. You got a lot of work to do out here, and I said, I think you're more valuable out here, earning your own living." And you are in jail living on the taxpayer. And he laughed and walked away.
Well, he could hardly read and write. Now this brings back something else. He could hardly read and write. And he wanted to, something he wanted to say to Sam. He didn't know how the hell to spell his name, White. Now this is actually what he did. He went to Sears and Roebuck catalog and got a white shirt. No, he did, and he copied that. Game Warden, he had that Mr. White survey.
Yeah, I remember that.
That's one way to do it. You see?
You know, there were a lot of them letters that I got that I should have kept. The museum pieces.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about Nenana in the early days and Tortilla and why we didn't retain the name Tortilla?
Well, I can't tell you too much. I'm working on the history of it now. But that was the name of the Indian village that was there at that time. And, of course, the starting of Nenana was Jim Duke.
when he started his trading post near the embankment of a group of Indians, and that was right, his roadhouse was right exactly, as near as I can find out from Nelson before he died, who knew Duke in 1903, right where the depot is. They went on up and they found Eureka, which was the rich one. And they staked the first two claims to come out, and then they went on up to the head of it. In the meantime, Joe Quigley and Horn had came in from the other way and were prospecting down on Glacier. And they went on in, they hit some good prospects. And they went on in and showed this gold and got across the stake and came back, and back came the stampeders with them. Well, then they went on up the Moose Creek, and they hit the Eureka Creek, and these two claims, they didn't even see Dalton and his partner, and they staked the rest of it. And here comes Joe and them down, and they'd only stake these two claims and everything else was staked from the time they get down there. So Joe actually started the stampede of Joe Quigley, but Joe Dalton found the rich ground. As you recall, those are the only two claims that were really any good at all. There were two down there tomorrow. I won't say that, but the only rich one.
Yeah, carrying 2-foot drag line in there.
Yeah, and then even Hossa went in later.
Yeah.
And then he did all right for a while. But Joe came in from Fairbanks, and Joe Dalton came in from the other way. I've got all that down, and if I had time to get some more of this published, I've had 2 or 3 pamphlets, and I'd like to get some more of it. God damn it, Jim, I don't know when I'm going to get time, because I got another good book I can come out with, too, but you know, you get time to do it.
Did you ever get a of the Black Bear?
Huh?
Did you ever get a of the Black Bear?
I know her, yeah, I know her. I know her, and I met Duffy, I met Tettlemeyer. But I didn't know them personally. I mean, know them like I know the other fellows, like you fellows.
I didn't know that.
Well, I don't smoke anymore, but I'll try one of them.
Okay, you can try one of them. Well, those are pretty good cigarettes. You know, I cooked for 7 years and a half, Sam, and I went from 180 up to 2.5 and started in again. I'll be down and drop right back down again.
I put them all together.
I'm going to quit again. I've got a developing cough again.
That's what it's like. That's trouble with me. That's why I brought you cold.
I couldn't get anywhere. Jars, pipes, red table.
Now, who are all those fellas there?
I don't know, but they're new. Different Chamber of Commerce.
Oh, that's
running the most of them, I guess.
Oh, this is Chamber of Commerce. Oh, that's what.
That's a pretty interesting story itself, that meal robbery.
Oh, yeah.
John, what year was that that you came in over the grandstand without any motor? Which year?
25.